ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to ACT Radio, Animal Concerns of Texas. I'm Liz Walsh.
And I'm Tom Linney.
Here on ACT Radio, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and also the best thing that one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, if you're concerned about your health, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Rosalind Morrison of the Animal Welfare Institute. That's a little later in the show, but first some news. Animal advocates around the world were horrified to learn of a Danish zoo that slaughtered a giraffe and then fed him to lions in front of children. The perfectly healthy 2-year-old giraffe, named Marius, was killed according to a Copenhagen Zoo spokesperson because he was considered surplus and his genes were already well represented in worldwide captive giraffe populations, despite a petition begging for his life signed by tens of thousands of people, an offer from a private citizen of nearly $700,000 to spare his life, and offers from the Yorkshire Wildlife Park, which houses Marius's brother, and a zoo in northern Sweden to take him. The Copenhagen Zoo also considered the killing of Marius to be an educational opportunity. Stunned spectators, including children, were invited to witness Marius's death and the feeding of his body to lions. A zoo spokesperson is reportedly proud of the event for the anatomy lesson it gave children, according to the Associated Press. But what it teaches children should give us all pause. By slaughtering Marius, the Copenhagen Zoo demonstrated apathy for Marius's life and his individuality. It illustrates the common viewpoint of zoos and most wildlife management agencies that individual wild animals, whether captive or free roaming, are not deserving of consideration as individuals. Only populations matter. And it highlights how this view translates into a lack of concern for the well-being of animals in zoos or other captive environments.
Contra Costa Times reports that in the largest bust since a ban went into effect in July, more than 2,000 pounds of shark fins were seized from a San Francisco fish vendor. Michael Kwong, owner of Kwong Kip, Inc., was cited after investigators from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife discovered 2,138 pounds of shark fin for sale inside his business. The discovery was the largest seizure to date, and according to officials, thousands of sharks were killed to produce this amount of fins. Kwong has been one of the leading critics of the ban. The bust marked the most significant citation since the shark fin ban went into effect July 1, 2 years after Governor Jerry Brown signed a law making it illegal to possess, sell, offer for sale, trade, or distribute the cultural delicacy. Despite the massive quantity of shark fins found in Kwong's warehouse, the 42-year-old man was cited and released, and no arrests were made. While typical violators of the ban receive a citation and a fine of about $1,000 for possessing restaurant-level quantities of the product, Kwong will receive his penalty from a judge at a later date. Officials estimate that between 26 and 73 million sharks are killed worldwide every year to meet the high demand for fins and say populations will continue to decline rapidly so long as unsustainable practices like this persist.
From the BBC, experts from around the world gathered in London to discuss the global crisis in wildlife trade. Conservationists say animal trafficking is reaching unprecedented levels and species such as rhinos, elephants, and tigers are under threat of extinction. The aim of the meeting, hosted by the Zoological Society of London, is to find new ways to protect animals and reduce demand for wildlife products. An action plan will be fed into another meeting hosted by the UK government. International leaders were joined by Prince Charles and Prince William, Duke of Cambridge. They have jointly released a video campaign urging people to unite for wildlife. Wildlife poaching has seen a recent boom and is worth an estimated $19 billion each year. In South Africa in 2007, 13 rhinos were killed for their horns, but in 2013, more than 1,000 rhinos were slaughtered by poachers. Elephants, too, are suffering dramatic losses. An estimated 20,000 of these giants were killed in Africa during 2012, according to work carried out under the International Union for Conservation of Nature. The conservationists at the conference also discuss ways to stem the growing markets for wildlife products and look at how conservationists can better protect animals.
The Center for Biological Diversity announced a $2,500 reward for information about the fatal poisoning of a Northern California dog owned by a leading researcher studying how the same controversial poison affects endangered species. The dog named Nixo died on February 3, 2014. He belonged to Dr. Murad Gabriel, who has been investigating how the highly toxic rat poison, Brota falcum, threatens wildlife, including Pacific fishers and northern spotted owls. A necropsy revealed that the dog had ingested red meat laced with the compound. Dr. Gabriel discovered his dog having seizures and found that he had vomited red meat, which the family had not fed to the dog. The dog was immediately taken to a local veterinarian who was unable to save the animal's life. Dr. Gabriel then drove the body to the laboratory at the University of California at Davis, where a necropsy determined that Nixo had died of the poison. Jonathan Evans, the Toxics and Endangered Species Campaign Director at the Center for Biological Diversity, states that the evidence strongly suggests that this malicious poisoning is tied to Dr. Gabriel's research. And if that is true, we condemn the use of violence to silence any scientist, researcher, or citizen whose work aims to conserve wildlife. He further states that this tragedy is yet another example of how the reckless use and sale of these poisons is ruining lives by indiscriminately killing pets and wildlife. The state of California and the Environmental Protection Agency have taken steps to ban hazardous decom products containing this compound because of the documented poisonings of children, pets, and wildlife. The decom product is still being sold because the manufacturers of it are currently challenging the EPA cancellation order. Many of these poisons include anticoagulants, which interfere with blood clotting, resulting in uncontrollable bleeding that leads to death. Second-generation anticoagulants, including Brota falcum, are especially hazardous and persist for a long time in body tissues. A coalition of nonprofit organizations, municipalities, businesses, and scientists formed the Safe Rodent Control Coalition to promote effective, affordable rodent control strategies. Groups such as the Center for Biological Diversity and Raptors Are the Solution continue to educate the public about the dangers of anticoagulant rodenticides. For more information, go to justiceforNixo.org. And that's Nixo, spelled N-Y-X-O.
Stay with us. Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Rosalind Morrison, Legislative Assistant at the Animal Welfare Institute. Some of our listeners may find some of the content of this conversation disturbing. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Rosalind Morrison. Thanks for being with us, Rosalind.
Thank you.
Rosalind, can we start out by having you tell our listeners how you got involved in animal issues?
Sure. Well, after I graduated from college, I moved to South Korea, and that was in 2009. I lived in South Korea for 2 years. My first year, I lived in a rural town in the southwest called the Cholonamdo province. And the little town was called Yeongwon, and it was tiny. There were only 8 other Westerners in the village with us, and it was very difficult for me. And within a month of living in Yeongwon, I came across dog farms scattered throughout the countryside, and I was completely appalled at the way these dogs were raised, the way they were killed, and the way in which they were treated. And so I decided right then and there that I wanted to try to campaign to end the dog meat trade, and I set about doing so over the next couple years.
So you weren't involved with any kind of animal protection or vegetarianism or anything like that before you went to South Korea? It was just kind of a turning point for you?
Well, I've been a vegetarian since I was 12. I was born to a vegetarian mother, so I never really ate that much meat, and I always saw my mom show just utmost compassion towards animals. I remember every time we took a road trip or every time, you know, we were traveling and we would come across a stray dog or cat, we would always pull over and help the dog and cat, bring them to the nearest vet or shelter. We always were, trying to help squirrels that had fallen out of the tree and other animals. So I'd always been a vegetarian, but I was never an activist per se until I probably moved to South Korea.
And so what did you find when you were, first starting and you were wanting to do something about the dog and cat meat trade? What was the climate like there? Were there already other organizations that were fighting it, or how did you get involved?
Yeah, that's a good question. It was really difficult at first because, in Korea, almost everything's written, obviously, and spoken in Korean, and so it's very difficult to come across English websites. So it took me some time, but I remember just literally spending hours and hours just researching dog meat trade in South Korea, animal welfare organizations in South Korea, animal protection in South Korea. And I finally came across a couple, one of which is called CAPES, which is Korea Animal Protection and Education Society. So I reached out to them, and the lady who runs this organization is called Haesun Park. And I believe a lady back in the States actually contacted me because she's a Korean lady who was living in America because she spoke perfect English. And, you know, they said that they would love for me to get more involved and to help them out. And so things just kind of went from there. And after my first year in the rural village, I moved to Seoul, which is obviously the capital, because I thought I could be more beneficial in the capital, where most of the other animal protection organizations were.
And can you paint a picture sort of for what a dog farm, I mean, for me, never having been to Korea, and for many of our listeners, what exactly is it? Are they only large farms? I mean, you mentioned small farms, but are there also large dog farms? And
how do they keep the dogs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So basically, the best way I can describe it, I think, I've never visited a puppy mill in the States, but from what I've been told and what, you know, from my research, I think they're somewhat similar to puppy mills in the States. And basically, there's no regulation. So this could be, you know, just an average man or woman who decides they want to keep a couple dogs in the back of their yard to make some extra profit. Or it could be, you know, someone who decides to make a career out of this and has hundreds and hundreds of dogs within, you know, their backyard. But basically, there are these wire cages, and they're usually lifted off the ground. And the dogs stand on wire their entire life, you know, so they sleep on wire, they stand on wire. They never feel the ground beneath their feet until they're dragged to their death. They're fed leftover human food, and I don't know if you've ever had Korean food, but it's very spicy and acidic, so it's not easily digested. You know, it's not supposed to be consumed by dogs. They're fed leftover rice, leftover kimchi, which is Korea's fermented cabbage, very spicy food. They usually don't have any water, and they don't even have water bowls usually. And these are, you know, five or six dogs stacked on top of each other, so they can't even move. And, you know, as you know, dogs fight to, you know, they have to establish which one is alpha. And so these dogs have open wounds all over their bodies. They're never treated. They never receive veterinary treatment.
Are they going to the bathroom on one another if they're stacked up like that?
Yeah, that's a good question. They usually just, because the bottom is kind of wire, so they can use the bathroom through the wire. But then, as you can imagine, over time it builds up, and the cages are never cleaned. So you can see the feces is just piled on top of each other. Oftentimes, you know, these dogs are fed steroids to make them, you know, grow faster and quicker. And also, a lot of times, there's actually been even cases where the mother dog has killed one of her puppies because out of starvation, these dogs resort to cannibalism. Yes. So it's really, really just terrible. I mean, I still to this day have nightmares at times over what I saw. And then, you know, what affected me the most was not the point that these are just, you know, dogs that are being eaten. It's the fact of how the dogs are being eaten. It's a superstitious-driven industry, and the superstition is if you instill fear into the dog before it dies, it makes the meat taste more tender, and it's a better aphrodisiac for men. So these dogs are either hung, electrocuted, or beaten to death.
Jeez.
And so it's not a quick death. It's very, very...
It's torture almost, huh?
I mean, it is... In my opinion, it's one of the worst forms of animal cruelty I've ever witnessed. And a lot of times, you know, Koreans like to say that it's just this one certain kind of dog, which they call a nurungi, which just means yellow dog, or dungke, which literally means shit dog. They say that they raise these dogs, and, you know, they can distinguish between these dogs and pet dogs. And that's just not the case. There have been many instances of purebred dogs that are, you know, that become dog meat. Pet culture is a new thing in Korea. And so a lot of times Koreans will go and get puppies and they're cute. And then, you know, when they discover that they tear up the house or they bark too much or they use the bathroom in the house, they just put the dogs on the street. There's a huge problem of abandonment in South Korea. And so then the dog trader comes along and picks up the dog. And then, you know, the story goes from there. So a lot of times you can see these dogs still are wearing their collars when they're in the marketplaces.
Oh, my gosh.
It's just terrible. And that's one thing I always was worried about with my dog over there. It's just, you know, when I was walking around, I would never leave her tied up outside of the store to run and get coffee or anything, because I had many Korean friends, and one of them told me that his dog was literally stolen when he was a child. He was like 12, and he ran into the drugstore, and when he came out, she was gone. And I remember he told me her name was Sandy, and that, you know, Sandy looks so much like my dog, Lucy. And it's just, it's really tragic to think that that could happen to your own dog.
Is dog meat, is it advertised in restaurants? Like when you go to someplace to eat, is it like just there on the menu?
Yeah, so it's not, let's say you and I are going out to dinner tonight and for some reason, you know, we eat meat, so we're trying to find steak or hamburger or chicken, whatever. It's not sold at a normal restaurant. You have to go to a specific dog meat restaurant. And the word for dog meat in Korean is either kaegogi. Kae just means dog, and gogi means meat, or bosintang, which kind of means like healthy dog soup. Tang just means soup in Korean. But, you know, obviously they're not going to always be that obvious, so they're all, there are other acronyms for it as well. One of the, another way of saying it is, I might pronounce it wrong, but it's, I believe it's yongengtang, which just means healthy soup. Sometimes you'll even see pictures of dogs. Korea, it's kind of interesting. When you go to a restaurant, so let's say we're going to get bulgogi, which is like ribs, they'll put pictures of the cows outside the restaurant so you know what you're going to get.
Huh.
So I kind of like it in a way, to be honest, because it's different than in America where, you know, most people that eat meat have never even seen how meat's made. They don't really think, oh, this is coming from an animal. In Korea, they're very upfront about it, you know, so they put a picture of the cow and you go into the restaurant to eat the cow.
But they don't have pictures of dogs out there, right?
Sometimes you can see them, but that's not very, I mean, it's very, very, very rare. But I saw these dog farms, I mean, literally, like I, you know, I'm not sure if I stated this yet, but I wasn't looking for this. I moved to South Korea because I studied French and international trade and a couple of other languages at my college. So I was always very interested in international affairs, you know, linguistics, et cetera. Always thought I wanted to work in the foreign services. So this is why I moved to South Korea. I didn't move there to do animal advocacy, but I'm glad, you know, I moved there because it obviously opened up my eyes to this terrible industry, and, you know, I'm very content with what I do now.
But it's not just dogs, right? There's other domestic animals that we consider pets that people eat over there too, right?
Exactly. Cats are killed. I'm not sure, you know, it's very hard to find out more on the cat meat trade in South Korea just because it's really, really so underground. But I know it's hundreds of thousands of cats every year, and they are actually boiled alive. They're usually thrown into sacks and then thrown into, like, a big cauldron. And they believe, the belief is it cures rheumatism. And so they liquefy the cats, and then you drink it. And I'm not even actually sure. I think it's, actually, I do know how to say it in Korean. It's Kyoyongi soju. Kyoyongi means cat, and soju is like a drink. Actually, their famous alcohol is called soju, which is kind of like Japanese sake. So it's really, really bad. And if you go to any of the open-air markets, you can see all this stuff. You can see the dogs in the cages. You can see the cats in the cages.
But you said it was underground, a lot of it. So is there pressure, international pressure, or why do they keep it underground? Do they know that most people outside of Korea find it unacceptable, or...?
I think they do, yeah. And they also become very defensive on it. Whenever I would try to talk to my coworkers about it, you know, you'd often get very different responses. But one of the main responses I would hear was, you know, Rosa, they called me Rosa, was my nickname. Rosa, we've been doing this for hundreds of years. This is part of our culture. Like I said, they always say this is a certain kind of dog. This isn't, you know, our pet dog. And what's also so ironic about the whole thing is a lot of times pet owners will have a pet poodle or shih tzu. They love small breeds of dogs. And then they'll go and eat dog meat soup later that night.
Yeah,
yeah, that's pretty interesting. Psychological shutting down part of the brain goes on there,
yeah.
Huh?
I mean, in some ways, we understand when people will go, you know, they have their dog, but then they'll go and eat a pig.
Well, right.
Some people make it, you know, don't make that correlation. But definitely when it's within the same animal, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Right.
So I'm curious about, are you doing this through Animal Welfare Institute as well as trying to combat, you know, these cultural beliefs and how these animals, you know, were supposedly benefiting you from a health perspective?
Yeah, I work, you know, we have a campaign here at AWI that trying to just help enforce. So, for example, you know, the dog meat trade is not just unique to South Korea. It's in several other countries such as China. Okay, let's see. It's China, South Korea, the Philippines, Vietnam, parts of Thailand, I believe a small percentage of Indonesia. So we're just trying to the Philippines actually made the dog meat trade illegal in 1998 with the passage of the Animal Welfare Act. And then they passed the Anti-Rabies Act in 2007, which made the penalties even higher. And so right now in the Philippines, we're just asking them to please enforce their laws. And in South Korea, we're asking them, you know, our message basically is that the trade is so inherently cruel. Basically, from birth to slaughter, the way in which the dogs are treated is so cruel. So we're working at this, we're working on to this end on a grassroots level, whereas, you know, I go and leaflet often on the weekends on the Smithsonian Mall. I've been up to New York a couple times to leaflet in other parts of, you know, around the states. And also we're working on it, you know, with legislators here on Capitol Hill. We've sent letters to the president of the Philippines, President Aquino, and former Secretary Clinton, just asking them to enforce their laws. And those were well-received. We were able to schedule some meetings with State Department and the embassy overseas in the Philippines when I was there. I spent a week investigating the dog meat trade in the Philippines back in March last year.
How is it there? Is it pretty well-developed as well?
It's not actually. You know, it was harder to come across while I was there, and I was there for a week, versus, like I said, in South Korea, I wasn't looking for this. I just kind of stumbled upon it. And it's interesting because when I talk to some of my other friends who've lived in South Korea, you know, it's odd because some of them say, I never saw that. And I just don't know how they couldn't have seen it because I saw it on a daily basis where I wasn't even looking for it. I remember one time specifically, I had run home from work to take my dog out for a walk during lunch break. And we're just walking down the street, and this truck drives by right beside us with cages full of dogs. I mean, just stacked on top of each other. Yeah. And these dogs look just like Lucy, like my rescue Korean dog. And I think that's what resonates even more is the fact that, you know, this would have been Lucy. Lucy, my own dog, would have been fallen victim to the dog meat trade. And I'm not saying this, you know, as a bias. She is legitimately the smartest dog I've ever had. And we've had dogs throughout my life. You know, I mean, when I was born into this world, my parents had a family dog. We've always had dogs, cats, you know, so many animals. And all my friends, everyone comments, you know, Lucy is so incredibly smart. So it's just, it's a shame that the dogs are treated the way in which they are.
So when you try to work on the issue in Korea, you have a lot of opposition from local people saying that it's part of their cultural tradition. It's really hard to fight that justification for bad behavior. And, I mean, people do it all over the world for justifying different types of anything from cockfighting to bullfighting.
Whale hunting.
How, right. You know, this culture, this, well, it's cultural, therefore it's okay. I mean, just because people have been doing things for centuries doesn't make it right, obviously. But how do you go about defending against statements like that?
I mean, that's a really great question, and that's something I've had a lot of difficulty with because I definitely don't want to look, you know, as if I'm putting my fingers to Koreans for eating dogs when, you know, here in the States we have all kinds of problems with how animals are treated.
Right.
But I guess my argument to that is you know, no one really knows how or when the dog meat trade started. Some say it started back in China thousands of years ago. Others say it was a result of, you know, famine during the Korean War when Japan tried to colonize Korea. But I guess my argument to that is if dogs were eaten, you know, in times of hardship, well, South Korea in the last 50 years has gone from, you know, third world developing country comparable to like a sub-Saharan African country to one of the top, you know, most industrialized countries in the world. I think it's like number 11 or number 13. So I don't think it's still necessary for dogs to be consumed in South Korea.
Right. It's right. Not a need.
Yeah.
It's
exactly.
A desire.
And it seems like there's health risks involved too. You know, it's if you talk about the dogs getting steroids or, You know, maybe they're going to the vet and they're getting these shots and then they're becoming part of the food supply. I mean, I wonder if that's that sort of recognition and worry is growing in Asian countries as well. I mean, you know, we see it here in the U.S. with, you know, people concerned about antibiotics and that
right.
sort of thing. Is it? Are you finding that at all? Is there any concern
for that?
That's
a great point. Yeah. So there has been a case, you know, this has been an issue in the Philippines. This is why the Philippines passed the Anti-Rabies Act, which, you know, even furthered the penalties for eating, consuming dogs in 2007. There's been rabies outbreaks, you know, in Thailand and Vietnam. To my knowledge, I don't know of any rabies outbreaks in South Korea, but I don't see why it couldn't happen, you know, since it's happened in these other countries. And like you said, a lot of these dogs are stolen pets, so if they were receiving veterinary care and had, you know, who knows what kind of shots they were given. It's kind of the same thing with horse slaughter, you know, here in the States, is these horses are not regulated, you know, they're not okay for human consumption.
Right.
If they've been given, you know, shots to make them run faster, I have no idea, you know. You know, the whole trade is unregulated, so it's just asking
Sounds dangerous.
For disaster.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
It's asking for any kind of disease.
I have one last question here for you. What about communities here in the U.S., like Korean communities or Filipino communities? Do they try to consume dog meat or...?
You know, that's a great question. Actually, we came across an incident a couple months ago where dogs were being consumed outside of Philadelphia in Pennsylvania. And so we went to Harrisburg a couple weeks ago to meet with a representative. His name is Representative Marr, to thank him because he's introduced legislation that would ban the slaughter of dogs and cats for human consumption. So it does actually happen here in the States. I've heard that it happens in back alley restaurants in San Francisco. So it's just a matter of time before, you know, we hear of more incidents. And ironically enough, there's not any, we don't have a law in the States that says it's illegal to eat dogs and cats. I think just because it's probably assumed that, you know, dogs and cats aren't usually consumed.
Well, this is definitely an issue that I think all of us can galvanize around and are passionate about. We love our dogs and we love our cats. Where can our listeners go to learn more about getting involved and potentially doing something here locally and maybe putting some pressure on the local, you know, on the embassy, Korean embassy, and other countries?
Yeah, that's well, it would be great if they could check out our website. It's www.awionline.org. AWI just means Animal Welfare Institute. /dogmeat. It'll take them to our website, and then you can click on the South Korean dog meat trade or the Philippines dog meat trade.
Thanks so much for being with us, Rosalyn. I feel like the time just flew by, and you know we're definitely very happy with the work that you're doing, and look forward to hearing more about developments.
Well, thank you so much for letting me talk about this issue. It's definitely one that's very close to my heart, and something that I hope will end sooner rather than later.
Thanks, Rosalyn, for all your good work.
If you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACK Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button.
And if you'd like to learn more about a vegetarian or vegan diet, you can go to the Vegetarian Society of El Paso website at vsep.org. I'm Liz Walsh.
And I'm Tom Linney. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.